by reading a sentence from the British journalist and critical radical activist George Monbiot, and he's writing on peak oil in the Guardian newspaper, December 2, 2003. And the headline is, "The world is running out of oil, so why do politicians refuse to talk about it?" He's talking about peak oil, meaning that anywhere from, some people say 2004, some people say up to, the U.S. government said up to 2037, the amount of oil that can be produced would be the maximum amount of oil that could be produced, and after that it's downhill. And some time ago, we've reached the reserve, the peak reserve discovery point. So he's concerned about this peak oil and the silence around it, and the silence around the implications. And I've been concerned about that for many years, which is why I've worked very hard to try and get at least a little bit of space at a public university for a serious discussion of oil. And I see that the science students are taking this up, and student groups are taking this up, and I hope this will give a lead to academics and to people who work on programs so that we make it the center of our curriculum, because it really is the absolutely critical issue of the day, and it will dominate the rest of our lives. Okay, so Monbiot says, "We seem to be in trouble. Either we lay hands on every available source of fossil fuel, in which case we fry the planet and civilization collapses, or we run out and civilization collapses." So we're damned if we do, we're damned if we don't. We're in a serious conundrum. What are we going to do? And he says, massive political pressure. Without massive political pressure, we will not have the complete reorganization of life in all parts of the world around energy conservation, around collectivity, without massive political pressure. And that's really the bottom line in my talk. Without massive democratic mobilization, direct democracy, forming of collectives, establishing of cooperatives, we truly are doomed. I think that for those of you who share my concern at the turn of the election, at Bush doubtless stealing the election for the second time, I can't believe with Diebold being the company producing the voting machines, which have never tested accurate, in Ohio, and the CEO of Diebold, the voting machine producer, declaring publicly that he would deliver the vote for George Bush in Ohio, that this was a fair vote. Plus, with 2 million American citizens incarcerated and therefore denied behind prison walls the right to vote, we could say if we added those, a good portion of those 2 million to the large number that did vote against Bush, we would have an overwhelming majority against Bush. So, I mean, this is yet another stolen election, and the implication, I was very, very depressed when I realized that indeed Bush was claiming and sustaining his claim to be in the White House for another 4 years. I was very sad. Why? Because I count in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, the people who will die, the people who will live a more constrained, limited, repressed life, a life less happy and less full as a result of Bush being in power. Now, it's not Bush as an individual, as we know. He's just a front for very serious corporate power. I would call it the weapon dollar, petrodollar coalition. We've got banks in there, we've got the weapon companies, we've got the oil companies. The weapon dollar, petrodollar coalition. And that's a phrase coined by the University of York professor, York University professor Jonathan Knitson. N-I-T-Z-A-N, Jonathan Knitson, whose work on oil and on corporate power is really quite worthwhile checking out. Jonathan Knitson, his website is very rich with information. Okay, so we're damned if we do, we're damned if we don't. We need democracy to get out of this conundrum. We see that democracy is being foiled on all fronts. Democracy is not easy. And we're going to have one kind of shining model of democratic practice, which is Venezuela, an oil-rich country in Latin America that many of you will be familiar with. And I'm hoping, if you've not already shown it, you will show the new film. There's a new film incorporating the coup attempt that failed against Chavez, and much more about the Bolivarian Revolution, the revolution of democracy in Frente Below. It's a great film. I have a copy of it. I'll make it available to you. Okay, in pursuing this whole question about oil, war, and environment, I want to structure the talk into four sections. And the first section has to do with the problem, the enclosure, oil company destruction. The second is popular resistance to that enclosure, that destruction. And the third is commoning alternatives, alternatives to that destruction and the for-profit commodified kind of political economy that's at the heart of that corporate destruction. Commoning alternatives, which have at their heart a different kind of political economy, focusing on the support and enhancement of life for all. And then I want to conclude with, well, what can we do? What are some of the international links that are being forged by people who are acting in the oil arena for a commoning alternative to corporate destruction? Okay? And at the end, I'm handing it back to you to say, well, what do you think we can do? Okay. So the destruction. Now, I've organized the destruction part, oil company destruction, first of all into the destruction at the different integrated phases from upstream to downstream in the oil industry. Upstream means what happens to get the oil, to find the oil and gas and get out of the ground, okay, and then flows downstream into our gas tank or furnace or electricity generation or whatever it's used for, manufacturing of plastics, which are all around us, our clothes and whatnot. Okay, so upstream, downstream. And the thesis here is that at every stage of this integrated chain of activities in the oil industry, from finding the oil and gas to its being transformed into, in effect, global warming, which is killing us and many species, in this whole process, at every single stage, there are very, very, very serious life-threatening, planet-threatening, negative, destructive influences. Okay? And I'm just going to illustrate that very briefly and then move on to talk about popular resistance to these destructive influences as they are experienced by people often very close to the destruction. This is a very immediate kind of response we get. And then how these different alternatives are articulating themselves and knitting themselves together internationally. Okay. First of all, exploration and production. We have seismic damage to wildlife and marine life. I'm from the bush in northern Alberta, and seismic lines have decimated the hunting, trapping economy completely in the north, as a flyover will demonstrate. There are intense amounts of cutting and disruption of an integrated terrain. I've just been working in Costa Rica. The seismic, we were able to stop the exploration production in Costa Rica, and that's the world's first country that's a complete no-go zone to oil exploration and production, a historical first. And one of the very effective elements of the campaign there was that fishermen had been keeping records of what kind of fish and how many kilograms they had been taking of particular fish, and they had been keeping these records for a very long time. So they were able to demonstrate right up and down the Caribbean coast that when the first seismic was shot offshore by Harkin, George Bush's oil company, Harkin Oil, that, in fact, the fish catch went down. The fish fled. So that was one of the very strong reasons for people mobilizing against, successfully against, any more seismic work and any more exploration in Costa Rica and on that coastline. So seismic is very damaging. Blowouts and land shifts, including earthquakes, follow upon withdrawing oil, some fracturing, some explosions underground, and withdrawing the oil and gas from the ground. And this is almost completely forbidden territory in most geology courses in the world. Most university studies, the only place this is studied is in the state, within the state oil company apparatus of Italy, because of their close connections, well, with trying to get gas out of the Po Valley in Italy and finding the Venice sank dramatically, and they had to then get gas from Libya and Algeria and pump up Venice again so it wouldn't sink. So they started to realize that if you take something out, if you reduce the pressure underground. There's a big hole in there, massive big hole. Things do fall in, right? They've worked on that a little bit. They've connected earthquakes. But this is a forbidden subject elsewhere in the world. Natural gas flaring. In Nigeria, the gas is flared. Almost all of it is flared. There's a lot of production wells, thousands of production wells, and the gas comes out, and it goes to a gathering station, a flow station, and it's burned off. And National Geographic last month published this huge map of the world from outer space that shows where there's burning and where there's light. And you see this great mass of light on the shore of West Africa, which is the Nigerian natural gas flares. This is the largest single civilian source of global warming in the world. That's basically Shell doing that. Very serious natural gas flaring. Sour gas, people in Alberta have been protesting sour gas. Sulfur-filled gas has been burned off. Kills animals, causes stillbirths and malformations of the fetus in all mammals. And the Ludwig family in Hythe, Alberta, demonstrated this with five kinds of mammals, including the three babies they lost amongst their extended family on their farm in recent years. They've documented this very well. Okay, ocean platforms and piping are very vulnerable to hurricanes and extreme weather, leading to devastating spills and destruction of the coastline and of coral beds and whatever else is in the sea. We have the example of the ocean platform disaster in Brazil in 2002 offshore, the platforms in the Gulf of Mexico that were destroyed in the October 2004 hurricanes. Let me go on to the next stage of the oil industry. Transport, storage, refining, and manufacturing. Of course, tankers, super tankers, big football fields full of oil, not double-hulled, not triple-hulled, as is recommended, they spill. We have Exxon Valdez in 89. We have the coast of Spain and Portugal devastated in the early 2000s, and an increasing number of spills. Pipelines destroy nature along their paths, and in fact, the movement of animals. They rupture. They are a vulnerable focus of violence and conflict. Petroleum products are toxic and carcinogenic. Plastics, pesticides, inorganic chemicals are highly carcinogenic, highly dangerous, and permeating our environment. We have the pollution of environments around petrochemical manufacturing operations. There's been a big struggle in many places, but in particular in Louisiana. There's been spillage. There's massive spillage and seepage around petroleum product storage sites, including petrol or gas stations. And then again, we have road transport of petroleum products, which is very polluting and dangerous. Finally, I come to consumption, the third general huge stage of the oil industry. And there we have the big problem of global warming. We have air pollution leading to a lot of respiratory deaths. Mexico City, Los Angeles, Toronto, Nairobi. We have global warming and extinctions from it. A big study has just been published, 2,000 scientists, UN scientists, have published in Science very few months ago, a big study on this, and it's quite alarming. They think that a third of all life will be on an irrevocable path to extinction by 2050. A third of all plant and animal species on the road, irreversible road to extinction. This is 2,000 UN scientists, very serious. We have petrochemicals, soil degradation, cancers, fuel oil-based electricity generation is very polluting. I hope we'll hear more about that tomorrow night. Waste disposable, plastics are non-biodegradable. They impede water flow. They kill many animals in rural areas that ingest plastic bags and so on, or other animals that get caught in some kind of plastic debris. We're now seeing the Walter Reed. There's been a study from the Walter Reed Hospital, south of Washington, that plastics are being consumed by humans and are causing cancers and other serious illnesses, of most alarming recent information. Let me go to part two. Another aspect of this enclosure in oil company destruction, which is the oil wars and oil company profits. And very briefly, this is work from Jonathan Knitson, who I just mentioned from York University, and his colleague, Shimsha Bishler from Israel. They did a very close study of oil company profits. And they have something called, they have a concept called differential profit. What they did is they took the Fortune 500 industrials, they added up all the profits, they segmented out the oil companies, the big oil industrials, and they said, what share of the Fortune 500, or are the oil company profits higher or lower than the average of the Fortune 500 industrials? And then they showed over a period from the 60s to the present that whenever the oil company's profits fell below the Fortune 500 industrials average, there was created, and they hypothesize, by the oil companies and the states they instrumentalized, especially the state of Israel, a conflict created in the Middle East, such that the profit, such that there was then a scare, a supply scare around oil, the price of oil would go up, and then the oil company profits would go up, until they again fell below the Fortune 500 average, and then the same thing would happen again. So they demonstrated this happening 10 times since 1967, which is a very robust kind of demonstration. Okay? You see there that the black line means that the company's profits are falling below the average, and the little sun, the energy conflict, the explosion follows soon thereafter. We have the 67 Arab-Israeli war to begin with. Then we go to the 73 Arab-Israeli war. Then the 79 Iranian Revolution. And the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq conflict that the U.S. Government funded, sold arms to, provided intelligence for both sides. That's when they built up Saddam as their friend, right? Their freedom fighter friend in the Middle East. Cheney being photographed with him. And then we have the 1990-91 Gulf War, and then, of course, well, I'm going to give you a little bit of an update. What happened after that, after we get into the mid to, well, really the last half of the 1990s, we found that the oil company profits plummeted. They went down very, very, very rapidly. And I'll give you a different kind of measure of that. In, I'm pretty sure it was 1982, the oil company profits constituted about 20% of the Fortune 500 industrials profits. And by the year 1999, that share had gone from 20 to 3%. And of course, we know what happened. We had the Pearl Harbor, the 9/11, which was the pretext for, which was allowed to happen. And then this was the pretext for the big oil war. And what happened to prices? Well, we are all feeling that daily. Prices escalated, and profits have been higher than ever before in the history of these large corporations. These are the world's largest, most powerful corporations. So we have a pretty tight machine operating on a world scale here around wars and oil company violence and high profits. I won't spend time going into the fact that the U.S. military has set up bases all over the world protecting pipelines, running training exercises, Colombia, Nigeria, all over Afghanistan, in all the stands north of Afghanistan, and in Iraq itself, three big bases, and throughout the Middle East. Oman is has a huge base. Okay, let me move to popular resistance. I'm getting the signal I have 10 minutes, so I'm going to really go through this quickly. Many of you will be aware of the struggles in Nigeria. Ken Sarawiwa, who was hung along with eight others on November 10, 1995, by the dictatorship in Nigeria for fighting Shell's pollution of peasant land in the Niger Delta. That struggle only escalated. Women were extremely prominent in seizing Africa's largest export terminal at Escravos on the coast of Nigeria on the 8th of July, 2002, holding it for 11 days and signing an agreement with Chevron Texaco, which was quite favorable to these peasant women, quite favorable. We also know that there's been a whole series of consumer boycotts over the last 20, 30 years, some very major, and I'll just mention a whole list of them here. There was the United Nations General Assembly sanctioned anti-apartheid oil boycott, Stop Oil to South Africa. I worked on that myself for 20 years, and that was tremendously effective. And I worked on it at the level of oil transport workers, oil terminal workers, but other people worked at the level of governments. There is a more recent Stop Esso campaign in the UK and on the continent in Europe. One quarter of consumers who did gas up at Esso petrol stations in the UK told a poll, a survey, that they had stopped. This is between 91 and 92. No, 01 and 02, sorry. There's a No Shell campaign around Burma, around Nigeria. In 02, the Oil Watch, there's an organization called Oil Watch International, it launched a campaign against Chevron Texaco, a global campaign to boycott those companies because of their pollution treatment of indigenous people. In the build-up, there's been popular resistance involving and spinning off from these other activities that I've mentioned against the U.S. invasion and militarization of Iraq. And these were a certain type of anti-war activity was stimulated and sort of was imitating or carrying further the Nigerian women's action, because what the Nigerian women did is they threw off their clothes to curse the oil company people and deny them basically a social life, ostracize them socially. And it is believed in many parts of the world that, in fact, people die if they're exposed to this kind of curse. And indeed, people do die because they're socially excluded. So that demonstration by Nigerian women against Chevron Texaco was taken up by women near the head office of Chevron Texaco in Bakersfield, California. And they started in September of 02 to demonstrate, to throw off their clothes and to make big signs on the beach and get photographed from above. And the first thing they did was, I think it was peace. And then this big, you know, large print naked demonstration technique spread all over the world, so that within 90 days it had happened in every continent, including Antarctica. Part of that anti-war protest, which had also the nakedness theme, but was more explicit, was the global theater project, the Lysistrata, which is a play by Aristophanes, I think it's a few thousand years old, whereby the play is about prostitutes and wives joining forces to deny sex and all domestic services to the menfolk until the men agreed to stop fighting. And so this play was done in 3,000 locations on 03-03-03, just a few days before the U.S. military started to bomb Baghdad. And it brought to the attention of a number of people not only the possibility of an international coordinated action, and it happened just after that massive global no to war demonstration that happened in every big city in the world and in many villages on 15 February 2003, happened just after that, and it raised the profile of women's struggle for life, right, against oil war and oil-related death. We have Venezuela, a big struggle there to take back oil from a corrupt elite integrated with U.S. oil companies. I'm not going to talk very much about that until I come to the next part, which is the kind of social alternatives being presented. The biggest struggle against oil grabbing is being marshaled now by the Iraqi people, and I want to salute them. We've got very courageous examples, successful examples of indigenous people expelling Petro-Canada and Texaco from the Ecuadorian Amazon and launching a political struggle to get legal reparations, a legal decision and reparations. This is ongoing. And they're also really the same people in Ecuador are fighting the OPC pipeline, which is an expansion of the pipeline that goes across very dangerous territory out to the Pacific from deep in the Amazon. We know of the actions of people around Sudan to get Talisman, which is British Petroleum, out of the Sudan through shareholder action. I might say we should salute the professors and staff at the University of Alberta who made a good campaign, quite a successful campaign through their pension fund to get out of Talisman, we should use that as an example. It is possible to do. Okay, now I'm coming to the commoning alternatives. What do I mean by commoning? I mean doing things in common for the common well-being, for the common interest, for all. And respecting the commons, reinventing the commons. The commons, that is, the resources and the social services and the ambience and the humanity that we share and that we all depend on. That's moving away from everything is bought and sold, a commodified way of life, thinking of oneself as a unit of consumption and a unit of production, an atomized, isolated, sort of functional unit within a capitalist machine. Okay, it's a whole different way of viewing reality and has a wonderful history that is ancient and doubt, and if we have a future, it's going to be this future, I suggest, right? Okay, alternative energy sources, I postulate, are only possible within a commoning or subsistence life-centered frame of reference. The oil companies are not going to do the job for us. The big capitalist firms are what John McMurtry recently retired from the philosophy department at this university. I recommend his books. John McMurtry's books are important. What he calls the corporate male gang. Right? The corporate male gang, according to McMurtry, cannot solve the problem because they are only governed by what makes a profit. And it's basically death and destruction these days that is making a profit. That's where the bucks lie. That's where what he calls, we've reached the cancer stage of capitalism, where there's just a constant consumption of what is and commodification of everything, every aspect of social services, of imagination, of have you gone to the bathroom lately in this university? Private space, right? Everything being commodified. So he's saying that within that model, you are not going to be able to have a switch that centers on reparations, cleanup, repair, sustainability, solving this damned if you do, damned if you don't conundrum that Georges Monbiot has brought our attention to, that we're in. Centering around the energy crisis, but having ramifications into every aspect of our reality. So, now, I'm a Marxist, and what is one thing about a Marxist's methodology? A Marxist never says, well, we should do this and that and the other. A Marxist always says, as a historical materialist, I want to see what people are actually doing and take note of that as a lesson for what other people might be able to do. Okay, so how do I approach this question of commoning alternatives? I look for examples, and I'm going to suggest some that I've found here. In Africa, we have large-scale reappropriation of private property, of land that's been privatized and alienated. Groups of people, especially in Kenya, where I've been working a lot lately, have taken over privatized property, re-socialized it, made it into a commons again, and are using it to produce not coffee for export, or sugar cane for export, but food for local consumption. And they are defending that whole exercise. Wangari Maathai got the Nobel Prize for Peace this year, in part for her association with this massive grassroots movement. Right? It's been recognized at that level. Another one is, I mentioned the Costa Rica commoning alternatives. Not only have the people of Costa Rica said, in a resounding way, no. And they ran it, they had an election, and they elected candidates, and indeed a president, who also said no to petroleum exploration and production, and yes to biodiversity, ecotourism, small-scale fishing operations, protecting the turtles and the rich ecology of this very special sort of landmass that connects North and South America and has the Pacific. If you stand on a certain hill, you see over there the Pacific and over there the Atlantic, the Caribbean, right? A very special landmass which is so rich biologically right at the in a tropical climate. So the Costa Rican people, of course, the society relies on imports of petroleum, and they are trying to make arrangements with Venezuela to get some kind of barter arrangement going where they don't have to get a lot of dollars or now euros and give it to Venezuela in exchange for their petroleum products. They were trying to work out something like Cuba has done, following that example. And the other commoning alternative that I want to present as extremely hopeful is that of Venezuela. And what's happened in Venezuela is very interesting, and it's highly gendered. It's basically poor women. 65% of households in Venezuela are female-headed. This is not too uncommon. I mean, large proportions of households are female-headed, especially in the third world countries. And Venezuela is dramatically a female-headed household society, and it is the poor women. 80% of the population are very poor in Venezuela because a little elite has cornered the oil money and control of the of oil activities, and hand in hand with larger U.S., but not only U.S., corporations, has just allowed a small group of people to benefit from the oil wealth of the country, and the mass of the people have been increasingly suffering from poverty and disruption. And Chavez, they elected him in 1998, and he instituted what he calls the Simón Bolívar Revolution, based on popular committees, highly decentralized, maybe 1,500 people, 2,000 people, have these committees, they elect these committees. And of course it's women who are on these committees, and what do they deal with? We're setting up health clinics, setting up education, setting up water supply, crucial, and setting up small villages of people on land that's been taken away from the big landowners, land that's not being used for anything, and that's been taken away from the large landowners, and defending that reappropriation, and then trying to organize these communities. And of course, the higher price of oil is helping Hugo Chavez, because there's enough money to import certain prerequisites. And also, the fact that the Soviet Union collapsed and Cuba was reliant on the Soviet Union for its oil products, for its petroleum, put Cuba in a very bad way. But then, after suffering along for about 5 years, Cuba made a deal with Venezuela. And it's very, very important to note that this is one of the reasons that the oil-dominated Bush administration is so hostile to Venezuela and Cuba right now. The hostility has gone up because there's a direct deal, a barter deal in oil. Oil for what? Cuba has, in part because of the Canadian CETA, the Canadian International Development Agency involvement through the United Nations Development Program with Cuba, Cuba has been able to train health workers in a remarkable way. A lot of health workers very well trained. You can go to a medical school, you know, sort of when you're six or something. You can prepare to be a medical worker. They have exported huge amounts of medical workers to Africa over the last few decades, and they have a big capacity to educate medical people. And they do the best plastic surgery and organ transplant work in the world, because they were helping people who were like tortured in Abu Ghraib and other places by the U.S. to reconstruct their faces and so on. So they developed that skill. And they also have, parallel to this medical training system, generic drug manufacturing capability, again, funded by CETA, organized by CETA, where they can produce the pharmaceuticals that will address the five most prevalent ailments in developing countries. And I can't name them all, but gastroenteritis, various kinds of diarrhea, malaria, common diseases, okay? So they have, the Cubans have exported 36,000 medical workers to Venezuela. And these committees, largely of women, are placing those medical workers in clinics and organizing the basic healthcare system that they've never had there. At the same time, these generic drug manufacturing plants are being set up, and the prerequisites are being purchased with the oil money, and now Venezuela is getting set to launch these generic drugs all over the world in massive sales campaigns, which is very good for the people that are suffering from lack of dollars to buy the high-priced drugs from the U.S. pharmaceuticals and European pharmaceutical corporations. Okay, so we see a basic democratic experiment in Venezuela being able to withstand a coup attempt in April 2002, a three-month lockout by this displaced and disgruntled elite within the oil industry, which of course coincided with the Nigerian shutdown, Nigerian popular peasant shutdown of the oil industry in Nigeria, and the cutoff of the oil from Iraq because of the U.S. invasion. So you had this management lockout from the state-controlled oil company sector in Venezuela at the same time, which jacked up prices more. Oil prices were higher as a result of all these shutdowns and cutbacks and so on. So there's a lot of oil money in Venezuela, and that money is being used by these democratic committees to provide a basis for life for 25 million people. And I think this is an example. The people withstood that lockout. They withstood the effort through a referendum to displace Chavez and his the constitution that was voted on by 70% of the people, and 70% of the electorate voted in favor of a new constitution, which is very radical, very, very radical from the point of view of the poor people, especially of women. It's the only place in the world where the unwaged housewife, the unwaged farm peasant woman, gets a pension because of her domestic labor. She has produced these children, she has serviced all these family members all these years, she can get a pension. Right? It's the first country in the world to do that, and it's something that I would love to see in Canada. This would be a progressive example to follow. So I want to stop at that point, but to just say that the kinds of initiatives we see in these countries in resistance to the oil depredation and destruction are now becoming internationalized. And I just give you just read off a list of examples of the internationalization of these initiatives. There's something on the internet called the Other Shell Report. It came out in 2002. The Other Shell Report. If you Googled the Other Shell Report, would you get that? Yeah. And, you know, Shell in its slick PR campaign, they say, tell Shell, do you have any problem? Tell Shell. Well, these people have. I think it's 6 different communities all around the world where Shell is messing them up, and they all got together, and they produced the Other Shell Report, and it's pretty riveting, and they have some demands. Direct deals, producer-to-consumer direct deals are another way, and we find the Cuban-Venezuelan example is very important here, but there's many, many other examples. The Soviet Union and India did this in the 60s, and this is one of the reasons for the Cold War, the heating up of the Cold War. It was because of the barter deals that Russia did with lots of countries, tea, oranges, all kinds of things that the Soviet Union needed. They got it by bartering oil, and this was not well received by the U.S. oil companies. It's one of the reasons that Cuba nationalized the 4 oil refineries owned by the U.S. in 1962 because those U.S.-owned oil refineries would not accept cut-rate, low-priced Russian crude. So there's a lot of history of direct deals and barter in the oil industry that we should become aware of and get ourselves prepared to make those sorts of direct deals because that really is the wave of the future. We found that in 2002, there was the world's first, as far as I know, simultaneous production-consumption strike. I won't go into detail. I've written about this extensively. It's on my website. But what you have is a significant amount of oil pulled off the world market by the Nigerian women's action to shut down the Escravos terminal and 12 other production station shutdowns in Nigeria at the same time, pulling about a million barrels of oil off the market. What is the oil market? It's about 40 million barrels of oil. Does anybody have an exact figure? I think it's about 40 million barrels of oil a day. So pulling about, 1/80th off the market and affecting prices. At the same time, you had a gear up of a lot of oil boycotts. So you have a global production strike and consumption strike simultaneously. Organized not by any individuals as far as I can tell. Maybe there was some shared individual, but it wasn't a concerted, organized production-consumption strike. It happened because of the integration of people through the oil industry, both all these different stages of the oil industry that I've mentioned. Right? That organization of the oil industry actually constitutes a powerful organization of people, all of us who are connected to these oil companies in whatever stage. Now, the reason I want to mention the production-consumption strike is a very important weapon in our hands is if we can shut down production and shut down consumption, we can also start it up in unison, in relation directly to each other. And the shutting down of it is the killing, the extermination of the multinational, the transnational oil companies. That's the death knell of big capital. Big capital cannot survive without producing oil and having it consumed. Our power is the power of the producer and the consumer jointly working together. And so when we saw in the year 2002 production consumption strikes simultaneously happening, we connected the potential of this for the future. Okay. The World Social Forum is doing a lot of coordination around oil. Oil Watch, there's an international organization called Oil Watch. You can Google it and get tremendous amounts of wonderful data, and it's regionalized. There's Oil Watch Africa. I'm going to a meeting in a few days in Accra, Ghana, where Oil Watch Africa have invited me to come and talk about direct deals, because the people of West Africa around the oil-producing operations are really upset, and they're really suffering now because of the U.S. military incursions there. And they want to get together and do a joint action. And it's going to be something like a production consumption strike, something like an effort to offer oil to collectives of buyers. I think I can end on that. And my last point is what to do. We have to establish democratic control over our society and its resources. That means establish direct, and then with this democratic control, establish direct deals and phase out oil in favor of renewable, sustainable, environmentally positive alternatives.